So we'll pray in a minute to start the Bible study, but let me tell you about the document from which we'll pray. It's called the Odes of Solomon. Weirdly enough, it has nothing to do with Solomon. The name of the Odes of Solomon is a relatively, you know, medium-sized mistake. As we said yesterday, basically the ancient authors never put titles on their work. So basically books don't have titles in the ancient world. The titles only get to happen when the documents are copied over and over again by scribes. Then, if you're a scribe and you're copying this one thing, copying another, you actually have to remember which is which. And so the scribes are the ones that give the books their names. So the Odes of Solomon actually have nothing to do with Solomon. They were discovered, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the discovery, which is one of the funniest stories. But the Odes of Solomon they sound very much like the Psalms of the Hebrew Scriptures. You know, that amazing kind of emotional character that the Psalms have, in which you're either yelling at God or praising God or pleading with God, full of emotion and quite poetic in its expression. Well, the Odes of Solomon sound just like that, and they have one difference. Well, many differences, but one difference that interests a lot of folks, and that is Jesus is in the middle of the Odes of Solomon. So in the middle of the Odes of Solomon, you'll either have stories about Jesus, or you'll have Jesus speaking. So these have that same poetry and emotional availability of the Psalms of the Hebrew Scriptures, but they have Jesus in them. So Jesus Psalms. So, for instance, we'll pray from your sheet, if you have one. There's probably a couple sheets left there. We're going to pray a little bit from Ode 8. We'll pray the first four verses. But you'll see later on in verse 8 of Ode 8, there it says right before verse 8, Christ speaks. And then so after that, that's what Jesus is saying in the middle of this ode. Well, I forgot to tell you how the Odes of Solomon were discovered. During the next week and a half, we're going to have all kinds of adventurous stories about who discovered what document in what part of North Africa, basically. So this is a different one, my favorite discovery story. There was a professor of New Testament in the late 1800s. Who was very famous for collecting new discoveries from the early church. He would go to the Near East about every year, but he mostly was just a professor of New Testament in England. So one day when he was in England, a student of his, and I can tell you this has never happened to me, a student of his came to him and said, you know, I wrote that paper for you last semester, but you never gave it back to me. Like, that's never happened. And the professor is crestfallen, runs back to his office, which is very messy. And he's searching around for this student's paper. And he lifts this up off one book of a pile of books and lifts this up off the desk. And he turns and he lifts another group of papers up and thinking, maybe it's in this pile. And underneath that pile of papers is the Odes of Solomon. The real Odes of Solomon. The only copy we've ever had. It's carbon dated to the second century.
Wow.
And he not only doesn't find the student's paper, he can't remember where the Odes of Solomon came from. Because he's been to the Near East so often and people are starting to send him stuff. So we do not know where the Odes of Solomon came except from this messy professor's desk. But Again, the papyrus has been authenticated.
There's a movie in there somewhere.
Yeah. And it sort of sounds like antique roadshow. In another way. Let's pray from the Oath of Solomon. Let's pray the first four verses out loud together. Open your hearts to the dancing joy of the Lord, and let your love abound from heart to lips, in order to bring forth fruits for the Lord, a holy life, and to speak with attention in his sight. Stand and be restored, all of you who were once silent. Speak, you who were silent, because your mouth has been opened.
From now.
Anybody who wants to pray any time can. I gave a bunch of you an assignment yesterday to, if you wanted to read the Gospel of Mary and the introduction that I wrote about it from one of the things I've written, you could. So let's because I yesterday talked way more than I wanted to, let's start with you about those of you who did read the Gospel of Mary and or the introduction to it. If you have any remarks, criticisms, or questions about it, let's start with your agenda, and in as much as that sort of basically runs out of gas, I'm right here to say other stuff.
Way too easy. Yeah.
The Gospel of Mary is way too easy?
No, the life that they tell us to lead in the Gospel of Mary is way too easy.
It's way too easy. Yeah. Nice criticism. Okay, say a little bit more about that, Mark.
Well, if we're all basically good and we're just trying to be human, if we're basically good and we're human, we've got it pretty much covered.
Okay. In other words, one might even say this book is useless because it doesn't get at the hard stuff?
No, I think it gives you a better perspective on how you should live.
Well, nice. Okay, thanks. Notice how the other remark could stand, right? Other thoughts about what you read in the Gospel of Mary or the introduction or questions about it? Yes, tell me your name, I'm sorry.
I read the introduction, I didn't get to the actual Gospel.
Oh,
I read the
introduction,
and it reminded me of what I said at the end of Andres and Amy's Bible study, that I sort of, it sounds a lot more like what I heard growing up.
Oh, I remember when you said that yesterday.
Yeah,
I noticed what I noticed about what you said yesterday and the similarity here is there was a lot of emphasis here on the teaching of Jesus and what that said about how to live. Mm-hmm. Yes, Linda.
I just in the first page of the introduction, I loved the part of child of humanity is within you. Mm-hmm. Because it feels so much more personal than the spirit of the Lord is with the child of humanity. And then that one, the throbbing enthusiasm for becoming a true human being. And that's the focus, that's the compass, the north, that's our north, to become a true human being. And then the part in here about talking about the things that challenge that, like anger and darkness and all of those things. So it's such a different way of looking at who Jesus was and what he was trying to direct us toward and guide us towards.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As I've been in pretty intense conversation with folks for the last several years about this gospel and some of the others, how that, Linda, is over and over again, the response is, wow, this sounds different than what I know. And you'll notice in the intro that I actually at the end say, is strange, because I would want to say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas all sound quite like it. That might just speak to the fact that either the Christian doctrine has been imposed on the gospel so intensely that it becomes difficult for us to read it on its own terms, or that we don't read those gospels much.
Or we're reading it with a certain pair of glasses.
Right.
We're hearing what Anders put up on that board.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Instead of,
yeah.
So this is a way of looking at a different, getting a different perspective.
Right. And for those of you who weren't here for Anders and Amy's presentation, yeah, they basically mapped out what I call, and others call, the master narrative of the Christian message. That is, what things are supposed to mean. Often in quite stunning contrast to what the Gospels actually say. Other thoughts or questions? Our way in.
I just think it's kind of nice to have a lady doing the teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Mary is a primary teacher. Of course, Jesus does teach in this gospel as well. Which brings us to one of the most disappointing things in my mind about the Gospel of Mary, that it's not whole, right?
Yeah.
We only have portions of it. There are about three papyrus columns at the beginning and three in the middle that are lost. And so one of the, I think, really crazy things about this is that the message, so much of the message is so attractive and engaging, but there is probably about between a quarter and a third of the material that we don't have. The most disappointing, of course, is when Jesus has left the disciples. The disciples are crying, and then Mary, Magdalene, we think, stands up and says, "Don't cry," because this was Jesus' last time they saw him. "Don't cry." They said, "Well, wait a minute, we're scared. If they crucified him, what will they do to us?" And so Mary stands up and says, "Listen, he taught me a bunch of things that he didn't teach you." And they say, "Well, give it to us." She says, "Okay." And then there's the gap. We miss about three quarters of what, according to the calculation, of what Jesus told Mary privately in this story. So that does remind me, just to oddly reassure you about the mess of ancient texts. So in their initial form, all of the texts, including the texts of the traditional New Testament, are very difficult to decipher. Amy?
Just to be honest, it's really pretty irritating to me that someone would come and say that they had the message, and then say, even in these other books, that "I'm not going to tell it so plainly to everyone, because then they would know and be saved, and I'm going to just tell it to some people and not others, and I'm not going to spell it out for everyone."
Right.
And the fact that it would be hidden from other people, that seems like a bad teacher to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Instead of someone who was coming to save everyone. Why would only some information be shared with some people? And then that he would supposedly choose one person to share this extra juicy stuff with, who then would share it with people, and then it's funny that it's not here, because it's like it's been hidden from you, and then it's hidden from us again.
Yeah, double hiding.
It just makes me mad, personally.
Mm-hmm. Right,
I just don't. I think that's a bad.
What kind of guy would do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like that's a great point. And if we had a lot of time, we could go through all the ways in which different early texts of the Christ movements, different ones, do that differently. In other words, one of the things we might say, and I'm not trying to get Jesus off the hook here, is that this is a common convention in ancient literature. for books. That is, to have the book be contained in the secret teachings that only you got. So I'm not wanting to say Jesus did or didn't do that. It's hard for me to say. But it's interesting that that happens in different ways in different books. So the Gospel of Mark, Jesus says that a lot. Next week we'll hear the secret revelation of John, and it has the same, what I would call literary motif, but it's just frustrating. Yeah. So the texts that we get all this from, just to say a little bit about the mechanics of them. So, and this applies, as I said, to the Gospel of John or the Gospel of Mark or the writings of Paul. So if you go to the oldest documents we have, let's say the Gospel of Mark, they're pretty hard to make out. First of all, the first complete Gospel of Mark that we have comes from the 3rd century. We're pretty sure it was written in the 1st century. But the first complete copy of the Gospel of Mark we have is 200 years after it was written. It's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And here's how it looks, just like all of the manuscripts. So can you read this one?
You have loved me since the world began.
Yeah, but you notice what's going on here is this is the way, and of course this would be in Coptic or Greek, but all manuscripts have no punctuation, no capital letters, and no spaces between the letters. And in addition, by and large, all papyri that you have also have this. That is, there's a hole in them. So the letters of Paul, for instance, you can't find any good copies in the 1st 7 centuries that don't have this. So then, let's see, if I said now, can you read this? It would be harder, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So so just to place that those big holes in the Gospel of Mary in that context, this is the name of the game. This is the authoritative words we have at the very earliest are problematically have lacuna, have holes in them. And we have to figure out and stare real carefully even to figure out the grammar of it. Okay, so I'm ready to kind of start in on some other, talking about some other things about the Gospel of Mary, but anybody else have some other things that they need to say about either yesterday's session or anything that reading this made you think about? Okay, so let's start with the figure of Mary Magdalene and the authorship of this book and the time it was written, just all of those kind of background materials. Here I'm going to be summarizing a lot of material in a short amount of time. And by the way, so this book by Karen King, Harvard professor of New Testament and Early Christianity, there's a lot of junk out there about the Gospel of Mary that is speculative and things people are imposing their wishes on it. Professor King's book is by far the best, and the really cool thing about that is that it is written for the layperson. So it's the best scholarly book on the Gospel of Mary, but it's also written with no five-syllable words that we professors like so much because we're so scared of not being able to explain what we do and don't. So I just want to say that I left 3 books here yesterday and said take them home and bring them back whenever before you yourself leave. Please study these if you want and take them to you. I mean not your way home, but your bunk tonight. during the week, and that applies to the book that Andres has over there. Mine, this is the book that the handout is from, and it's my introduction as well as the text. It has a lot of other early texts in it. So it's, we've had a lot of time to think about when the Gospel of Mark is written. We've only had probably 30 or 40 years to think about when the Gospel of Mary is written. So we're really, even, it's, you know, yesterday I said we New Testament scholars make half of what we say up. This is even worse. To try to figure out when the Gospel of Mary is written is mostly guesswork. Professor King says probably around 120 CE or AD. And that is about the time that many of us now think the Gospel of Luke is written. Interestingly enough, both the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Mary are very interested in what one might call sexual politics of what it meant to be a follower of Christ in those days. So maybe 120. You can find people who say it was written in 80, and others that say it wasn't written until 180. So what do I know? For whom was it written? It's also really too early to think about that, except for, as I was saying yesterday, when you hear some of these documents and you don't really know who wrote them, you try to hear what they're trying to work on. And one of the things they're trying to work on is what Lynn said, that is, so who are we as people? And this has a really stunning take on that. We are children of humanity just like Jesus is the child of humanity. We don't quite know for whom this is written, but in some ways you might say that it's written for people searching for an identity, and how God can bring to them a new sense of who they are. The other thing we notice about the content of this, just briefly, then we'll be reviewing this again, is so this is really a plot. Here, the plot of this book is, so Jesus left, everybody is afraid, Mary has a secret teaching and tells them, and then when she finishes her teaching, Andrew and Peter say, get serious. This can't be right. And then Mary starts crying. And then Levi stands up and says, listen, Peter, you're a hothead. You know that she loved, or he loved her more than any of us anyway. And then we have two different endings to the Gospel of Mary. As you may know, there are four different endings to the Gospel of Mark. But here you have two different endings to the Gospel of Mary, one in which Levi goes out and proclaims the good news of the child of humanity to everyone. The other, in which all of the disciples go and do that. In neither case can we quite figure out whether Mary went with them. Because, you know, of course, we think that there were 12 disciples. It's not at all clear that this gospel thinks there are 12 apostles. And Karen King thinks that that Mary, being the most beloved of all the followers, was also a disciple, according to this book. Well, as I said yesterday, this protagonist, this hero in the story, Mary, we don't quite know what Mary it is. Most scholars think it's Mary Magdalene. It's almost certainly not, by virtue of the way she relates to Jesus, not Mary the mother. But it could be, as we noticed yesterday, Mary of Bethany. And then we have a really weird thing going on, that a quarter of all women in Galilee at that time are named Mary. So let's guess Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, historically, although, for instance, we're not at all sure that there was a historical Judas, we are quite clear that there is a historical Mary Magdalene, that she was a peasant woman who lived in Galilee, the northern part of Israel, and she lived under the power of the Roman Empire, and she was part of the inside following of Jesus. That across the documents, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, all name her as a central character, as well as Mary, as well as the Gospel of Thomas. And Mary Magdalene is probably most famous for that passage in the Gospel of John, where she is the one who witnesses the resurrection. The so-called fathers of the church in the first four centuries, they're really fond, as I said yesterday, of Mary Magdalene, because she's the only one who saw Jesus before in the story, before he ascended. So Mary Magdalene is a big deal. The interesting thing is that peasants in Galilee, it's hard to find any documentation that peasants in Galilee knew how to read or write. So if Mary Magdalene is a primary real historical figure in the earliest of Jesus' movements, it's almost certain that she didn't know how to read or write, as it's almost certain that Jesus didn't either. By the way, in the Gospels, in the canonical Gospels, Jesus only reads one time. And that's in the Gospel of Luke, and Luke upgrades everybody, because Luke is probably a richer author. Luke puts fancier roofs on the houses and everything. So it's probable that neither Jesus nor Mary knew how to read or write. And of course, women had less of a chance of learning that than men, but less than 5% of all men in Galilee knew how to read or write. That's why when you learn to read in the ancient world, you always learn to read out loud, because you know what you have learned is an absolute gift to most everybody. So when you're practicing to read by yourself, or you're just reading for your pleasure in the ancient world, you're always reading out loud, because that's what reading is about, is everybody here, even when you're alone. As I say in the intro, it's almost certain that Mary Magdalene did not write the Gospel of Mary. First of all, in the story itself, it's not in the first person, right? It's in the third person. And secondly, it's quite difficult to imagine that the fantastic leader that Mary Magdalene almost certainly was historically knew how to write. The other thing is that as we get into, and we'll see this especially tomorrow when we're thinking about this, this author knows his or her Greek philosophy quite well. So we're pretty sure that this author is a relatively educated person, not only knowing how to write, but is someone who has read Greek philosophy, because the things that Jesus taught her in this story are informed by Greek philosophy. So, who's the author of this? We don't know, as we don't know the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. It's pretty clear that it wasn't the one that we want it to be. Questions or thoughts before I jump into some other issues? So, Linda, you've started us off on this very central teaching. It's the summary teaching of Jesus before he leaves. It's basically pronouncement that for beware that no one lead you astray, saying, look over here or look over there. For the child of humanity is within you. Follow it. Those who seek it will find it. Go then and proclaim the good news of the realm. Do not lay down any rules beyond what I have determined for you, nor give a law like the lawgiver, lest you be confined by it. When he said this, he left. So that's kind of the summary word from Jesus in this document. Linda has pointed out how this really focuses on the identity between Jesus' identity of child of humanity and us being humans. This fits very well with what we'll talk about a little bit later, is the insistence in the Gospel of Mary that there is no such thing as sin. In other words, the goodness of being human is at the heart of what Jesus has to show. Jesus' teachings are primarily about the his child of humanity-ness and our humanity being mutually informative. Just to remind us, so in Christian doctrine, often that's not the case. That often there is a real divide between how great Jesus is and how dubious or problematic we are as humans. And so here it's, I think, a surprise to us on one level that the central message is about the goodness of humanity. And that's the central objective, is being that goodness. I want to say here, though, that it's funny, again, that we should be surprised. So when you look at the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas, especially, you have constantly the invitation to follow Jesus. Basically, the main thing that you do in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas, and Mary, is you follow Jesus on two levels, right? On one level, Jesus says, follow me, and so you go into the story and you experience who you are by being in the story as his follower. But the other thing is that you actually follow the story, right? So there's a following of the story which mimics or complements the following of Jesus in our imagination. So here, of course, I would want to say Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas is also the model for who we are. Now, tomorrow I'm going to get into the Gospel of John, and I'm skipping that because it comes down finally where this does too, but in a slightly different way. People aren't as encouraged in the Gospel of John to follow Jesus as they are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But so I want to say that this being a human like Jesus is a human, I think, common to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Mary. And you, for instance, you don't have Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke primarily focusing on how sinful you are at all. Very similarly to this saying of Jesus in the Gospel of Mary, there Jesus proclaims the realm of God or the kingdom of God. And there he has, in Luke 17, he has almost the same phrase, right, as we just read, but there it's about the realm of God. He says, hey, some people say the realm of God is way up there. Some people say it's way over there. But I say it's right within you. It's right among you. So a very similar presence is announced in the Gospel of Mary and those three other Gospels. That is, that the good news is that the realm of God is hiding right under that stupid mustard weed. Or, here in the Gospel of Mary, it's that we and Jesus become the same person. The same kind of humanity. Questions, protests, thoughts? So this fits with what we were talking a little bit also with Anders and Amy yesterday about this sin deal. Basically, often Christianity seems to be really interested in convincing us as to how bad we are and how sinful we are. Now, yesterday we were noting the notion of original sin. That is, that somehow who we are at our very core originally has to do with enslavement to sin. In the Gospel of Mary, Jesus says, no, there's no sin. It's just an illusion. And there are a few other phrases like that. That, too, of course, comes to us as new. And again, here I would want to caution us about underestimating the New Testament in its traditional form. Because, actually, I want to say Paul is very close to the Gospel of Mary's message. For instance, in Romans 6, Paul is talking about, he starts talking about baptism. Now, you remember baptism in the early movements is not like that little drip of water that we get and give, but it's a bath. The word baptism in Greek means bath. So if you are baptized in that text, in that language, it means you are given a bath. So in other words, we know that what we call immersion with probably quite a bit more festivity than now was the way that was what happened. So Paul says in Romans 6, when you go down into the bath, you are buried with Jesus. And so when you come out up from the bath, you are risen with Jesus. I say this is the only eyewitness account of the resurrection in the Bible. That is, according to Paul, the resurrection happens when you get baptized and come up out of the water. This is not a thing in the future. It's a present reality. And then Paul goes on to say, and after you're resurrected, meaning after you come out of the bath, you sin no more. You're free of sin. Now, it's true that we need to interrogate the Gospel of Mary and Paul to know, what do you mean by that? The curious thing is that we haven't decided we needed to do that. We're so convinced that we're sinful and that that's the Christian message that we don't even pay attention to Paul saying, and there's no more sin for you after you come out of the bath. I guess for me, it's not, therefore, so much that the Gospel of Mary is some radical new message from the Christ movement, so much as it's put in such a stark way that it might get us into thinking about, I wonder what the early Christ people meant when they say, sin's gone. Surely they didn't mean that they weren't lying to each other or weren't hurting each other. Wonder what they meant. That would be another week. Yes?
I have a concern about how that passage you mentioned, Romans could be interpreted, and I think has been, in that there could be this sense that, you know, only Christians are sinless or perfect. Because mm-hmm. you've been baptized,
right.
because you're a Christian,
right.
you know, you're sinless, and mm-hmm. that anyone who's not a Christian, therefore, is sinful.
Yeah.
That's a concern for me.
Yeah, for me too. And it's too bad that the Gospel of Mary text is broken there, that we don't have the conversation right before that, because this is basically the beginning of the Gospel of Mary, and it comes in the middle of a conversation with Jesus and his antagonists, actually, as well as his supporters. So, yeah, I have to say there is a way of reading it that way. Nevertheless, it's still a way of thinking that is pretty, has a power, I think, that needs to be both interrogated and that we can dive into. In other words, I would say, I mean, just for instance, if we are free from sin, why do we confess it every Sunday? In other words, it seems to me as if they have a vocabulary around sin that's pretty different than ours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here, you will tire, I think, of me saying this in the next week and a half, but one of the great things about these new books that have been recently discovered is they deconstruct at the same time as they end up being close to what we know. So it's a help, a way of us kind of stepping back and saying, wait a minute, what is this thing? Can we look at it again? I told you yesterday how, as I'm speaking to folks in a bunch of different places, I keep hearing this image over and over again. People say, when I read the Gospel of Mary, I feel like I discovered my long-lost sister or brother. Meaning, oh, this really does sound like it's in the Christian family of texts. But like a sister or brother, it's not exactly the one I know. It's a little different. So thanks for that.
Speaking of kind of a long-lost sibling or self, when I think of, because I was raised in the Missouri Synod, Lutheran Church, so I don't meditate very often, but I can think back to this time where I was very bold and very secure and very calm and very ethical and had a sense of what was right, regardless of what the church told me. And I only if I meditate on the time between when I was born and 2 weeks, which is when I was baptized. And after that, it's just sort of, oh, you're this, and this, you're not good, whatever. So,
that
is sort of obviously mixed bag.
Oh yeah, so that in that way.
Yeah, but there is still that sort of other sense that sort of goes beyond that can still be reached perhaps at that age.
Yeah, and it seems like most of these conversation partners here are adults. So this is, we're not talking about childlike innocence. We're talking about a sense of not being. Having to take a reality of sin into account. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the interrogations that I would want to encourage as we begin to try to claim some of this is to say so that I wouldn't myself want that to release me from responsibility.
Well, then I'm not suggesting that. It's more that I can have a sense, like I said, of having a more ethical way of being that doesn't have much to do with, even in that sort of youth, it's not really an innocence, it's more of a knowledge kind of thing
yeah.
of how to truly be a more compassionate person, and it has nothing to do with
And notice how this fits so well with that passage about knowing the child of humanity is close to you. Knowing Jesus and you are really very close. In as much as that happens, there's a lot less sense of powerlessness and struggle to be good. You've got a companion.
Well, there's more of a responsibility, but there's also a sense of assurance, okay, I can do the right thing here. So how would you, I mean, I keep thinking about sin is illusion, oh yeah, okay, so how would you say sin is illusion than this? What would you say? Sin is illusion and we are children of God.
We are, yeah, yes, we are.
Sin is illusion, our life is in companionship with the child community.
The primary defining character of who we are is our intimate companionship with Jesus. And therefore, see, there's where Mary comes in, because Mary is the one who not just says this, she knows it. Because she's portrayed in this story as the one closest to him. So her ability to stand up and say, stop crying, has to do with the fact that she and he were companions. Just one word about that. We in our day sexualize everything. There's no indication that this book is particularly interested in Jesus and Mary being married. Mary here doesn't have her authority by virtue of being married to Jesus. She has her authority because she is herself a leader and a teacher. Well, anyway, my time's up. So my plan for the next 2 days is to look tomorrow at that teaching of the ascent of the soul in the Gospel of Mary, and to compare it to very similar passages in the Gospel of John, and in Paul, by the way. And to note, we'll go over this in detail, but it looks like this is not the ascent of the soul after you die. This is an ascent to the soul, of the soul while you are still living to God. So this is becoming one with God while you are in this life. By the way, Paul says in 2 Corinthians, I ascended to the second heaven. Not when I was dead, when I was alive. So we'll do that tomorrow, and then on Thursday we'll return to some of what we were talking about yesterday and look more completely at the Gospel of Mary's portrait of gender and what it means to be men and women together. Thank you.